Purple Heart.
Nice left.
Those weapons of mass destruction gotta be somewhere.
By 2014, the war in Afghanistan will be over.
Nice left.
Well, you know, general is not necessarily a general.
No weapons over there.
He may be a communist. Nice left.
Hey everybody, welcome to Eyes Left. This is your co-host, Spencer Rapone.
And your other co-host, Mike Preisner. If you didn't hear our debut episode, episode zero, make sure to give that a listen to understand exactly what the show is, what it's about, who it's for, and all that good stuff. But for now, just to get into it, it's time for the Afghanistan War update.
We will win this conflict by the patient accumulation of successes.
Our troops will continue coming home at a steady pace. By 2014, this process of transition will be complete.
The consequences of a rapid exit are both predictable and unacceptable.
Yeah, so we figured we'd begin our broadcast talking about the war that's been going on longer than any other war in recent history, but that simultaneously nobody really talks about anymore. It's quite a hidden war now, of course, so hidden that at the regular Pentagon press conference on Afghanistan the first week of July, the room was completely empty except for four journalists.
Yeah, really unbelievable. I mean, you'd think that, you know, the longest war in U.S., longest occupation in U.S. history would receive some kind of, you know, attention from the press, you know, which seems so focused on issues related to national security that of course that a war where soldiers are being killed and maimed on a regular basis and where civilian casualties are at a record high, you'd think they'd care about it, but they actually don't. You know, so much so that now even, you know, casualties of the Afghanistan war are just completely ignored in pretty much all of the media. And so the fact that this room is empty, it shows that, you know, the mainstream media doesn't even care that the Afghanistan war, which is a disaster, never-ending disaster, they don't even really care to report on it anymore. Many people don't know that so far this year, four U.S. troops have been killed in Afghanistan. And so for those in the military who think that, well, the war is pretty much over and casualties are low, deaths are still happening and loss of limbs and other horrible maiming injuries are still happening.
Yeah, most recently, in fact, on July 12th, Sergeant First Class Christopher Salise, on his fifth deployment, he was in the 1st Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, much like myself. And he was the most recent casualty overseas. So again, I was there 7 years ago and nothing materially has really changed except for the fact that it is far worse, far more destabilized on the ground. And that much like people died 7 years ago in the pursuit of a nebulous goal that was never really defined, so too do people. Whether it's from my unit or Mike's former unit or whoever's listening's former unit, everyone should be paying attention because guess what? The same situation keeps occurring again and again, and all it's resulting in is more death for people you might directly know, who are your fellow American citizens, or people who are truly oppressed and truly under the heel of imperialist violence, those of the Afghan people themselves.
Yeah, and you know, this Sergeant First Class Salise, who was just killed just, you know, days before this broadcast, he was on his fifth deployment. I mean, fifth deployment. I mean, if you think you can escape by, survive one deployment, guess what? You're going back many, many times. And so it's, you know, and this is not an anomaly. I mean, there's been people who have been killed on their like 10th, 12th deployment. I mean, I think one really incredible thing that there is to point out about this war being so long is that also this month on July 7th, a young corporal named Corporal Joseph Maciel was killed in Afghanistan in one of these green on blue killings, which is a rampant incident in Afghanistan where U.S. troops are killed by the very people that they're supposed to be training to take over the country. And so this idea that, oh, the war can end when we can hand over security to Afghan forces. I mean, that's like the leading cause of death right now is those forces just killing the U.S. troops during training. But the thing I wanted to mention about Corporal Maciel, who was just killed on July 7th, he was 20 years old. That means he was 3 years old when the 9/11 attacks happened. I mean, too young to remember the 9/11 attacks happening, grew up his entire life with the Afghanistan war going on, and then he ends up dying there. Really speaks to the absurd, endless nature of this war, where people that are you know, too young to remember it are now the ones dying in a war supposedly because of the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah. And it's really, truly upsetting because even within the military mindset, within their own framework, it's completely insane. I mean, Sergeant First Class Saliz, in his, you know, small profile they issue, you know, once it's announced that a soldier has been killed in action, the Vice Chief of Staff, General James McConville, said, "I can tell you that Sergeant First Class was a hero." You know, just, "I can tell you that Sergeant First Class." What does that even mean? Just these empty platitudes, you know, and imagine telling that to his family to comfort them that, you know, one of their loved ones is no longer with them. Oh, he was a hero. Well, a hero for what? I mean, and I recall, you know, when I got back from my deployment, fortunately, no one in my company was killed, but there were two Rangers that were killed in Bravo Company. I'll never forget the battalion commander. You know, he was working up his crocodile tears at the memorial ceremony, and he actually pronounced one of the guy's names incorrectly. And it just shows you how much these motherfuckers at the top of the chain of command don't give a shit about you whatsoever. So even like for the true believers, if you completely embrace all this, well, how can you not see that they, even within that own framework, they don't care? I also, you know, it brings to mind a conversation I had early in my days at West Point. I was asking one of my instructors, you know, "Can you tell me, sir, what is the strategic objective in Afghanistan?" And he said, "Well, you know, it's interesting, is at a panel discussion with, at the time, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey." People were talking with him off the record at this panel. He said, "You know, I got to tell you, I myself cannot tell you what the discernible strategy is in Afghanistan right now." Now, and it's not to say that, of course, no strategy would justify it. It's completely morally reprehensible, full stop. But even within their own framework, there's no logic to it. All it is just a reproduction of death and violence on a large scale.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so much death and violence that now the latest figures, which were released this month in July from the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, has reported over 1,600 civilians killed and 3,000 wounded, including 1,300 children during the first 6 months of 2018. This is the most recorded in the period over the last decade since the agency began documentation. And so all the Afghanistan war has succeeded in, even from that strategic perspective, is just causing much more death and destruction than it ever has. And of course, you know, any journalist on the ground there, any person with any sense on the ground there will tell you that, yes, there are reactionary forces on the ground that are vying for power, but that the main problem there is the presence of U.S. forces, and that all of the things that need to change in Afghanistan, you know, start with U.S. forces leaving, and then it can begin to move on from this dark era. But, you know, it's interesting when you mentioned that that commander in your unit that couldn't even remember the name of his own soldier that was killed. You know, I'm sure he got some kind of Bronze Star or something for that battle that his soldier was in while he was back safe in the command center.
Right. And you know, this most recent piece that came out with, you know, the most staggering civilian casualties in the course of the war, there was this report conducted on the 12th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. So this is an older piece from 2015. So it had been, of course, 14 years after the invasion of Afghanistan. And it was posted to Common Dreams, but the Physicians for Social Responsibility, Physicians for Global Survival, and the Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War conducted a joint study wherein at least 1.3 million lives total lost in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone. And now that's a conservative estimate, far more likely in excess of 2 million. Now the breakdown within Afghanistan alone, there have been nearly 170,000, almost 200,000 civilians killed, many of them not even immediately identifiable, just because they were blown to smithereens, but whether it was by A-10 or JDAM, what have you. This study, its data was pulling from 2001 until the end of 2013, and of course it was published in 2015. But now we see that even after this 100-page document comes out, you know, which is conducted by reputable sources, it's peer-reviewed, that still nothing on the ground has changed, and we're playing the same old game. And now it's come to such a fever pitch that more civilians than ever are just being murdered senselessly.
Yeah, it's really, really so terrible. And I mean, and that's what you're risking life and limb for in the military. You're asked to go risk your life, risk losing limbs. In fact, I think the most common wound in Afghanistan now is wounds to genitalia from foot patrols and stepping on IEDs. You know, that's a pretty big risk to take, you know, to willingly go somewhere where the biggest threat you face is your genitalia getting blown off. And all of this for a war that, as you said, you know, when you were at West Point, no one can explain the strategic objective of it. And it's accomplishing nothing but unleashing, you know, really terrible suffering on people who aren't our enemies, people we have no reason to be fighting at all. Really terrible state of affairs. Of course, anyone would be justified in refusing to take part in it. But there's a really big story that just came out that kind of blows it all out of the water. You know, the entire time that we've been made to go fight in Afghanistan, the reason that, Spencer, you were deployed to Afghanistan. I mean, from the very beginning, the whole premise was because of the 9/11 attacks. I mean, even though that, you know, maybe in the future we can get into the history of the Taliban and U.S. interests in the region. But, you know, when the 9/11 attacks happened, the Taliban contacted the U.S. government and says, we will turn over Osama bin Laden to you. But of course, the United States said, no, we're going to carpet bomb you, invade and occupy the country. And it was all about removing the Taliban from power. I mean, even the CIA at the time said that there is about 50 Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. I mean, that's the size of a football team. Yeah. So to say that you need like an entire army to go bomb and invade and occupy to take out like 50 dudes and a training camp didn't make a lot of sense. And all of a sudden, it stopped being about Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And all of a sudden became all about the Taliban, people that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. And in fact, you know, the majority of people in Afghanistan don't even know what the 9/11 attacks are. In fact, there was like a survey conducted where like 97% of people in Afghanistan had no knowledge of the 9/11 attacks or even what it was, that it was a thing. But the entire premise that we've been told why we have to risk life and limb for, you know, nearly 20 years now is that the Taliban are such a terrible political force that we must drive them from power and we cannot allow them to have any space in Afghanistan. Otherwise, we're going to get attacked again by terrorists and they're just going to be terrible to the Afghan people. You know, this was the crux of Obama's speech when he announced his troop surge in Afghanistan, when he was announcing the end of the Afghanistan war. Promising it was going to be over by 2014. But before he ended the war, he was going to greatly expand it, bigger than it ever had been before. This entire thing was, the premise was, we must beat back the Taliban. We must drive the Taliban from power. It's the most important heroic thing. And all the speeches, like the ones you heard in the obituary of this soldier that was just killed in Afghanistan, was that they are heroes because they are giving their lives to fight the Taliban and prevent the Taliban from political power. Big surprise to everyone, the Trump administration just announced for the first time that it's open to entering in direct talks with the Taliban to negotiate some kind of peace settlement where the Taliban is in charge of a certain part of the country and the U.S. Propped up government in Kabul is in charge of some part of the country. Spencer, what do you think about that? All of the missions you went on and all of the risks that you put yourself at was for this reason of stopping the Taliban from being in power. Now the U.S. government is saying, actually, never mind, we want to work with them. How do you feel as an Afghanistan veteran that that's happening?
Well, I mean, it's part and parcel, in large part, of U.S. Encroachment and involvement in the region for the past 30 to 40 years. I mean, in the early 80s, the Mujahideen fighters were funded directly by the United States government, and many of those would later go on to form the initial cadres and groups of the Taliban in the wake of the Afghan civil war in the 90s. So it's interesting to me because, you know, the whole Trump campaign was run on this idea that he's going to be the one not to to buckle. He's the guy that's going to come out here and be the strong man. He doesn't negotiate with terrorists. He's going to be the face of a resurgent America. And yet, we see that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who's in office. It's just all typical realpolitik that's been going on in the region, whether it was the British Empire in Afghanistan to the U.S. Today. But you know, at the end of the day, you can't be too surprised with it, because when I was overseas, I was told that we were fighting the Haqqani network, which is another like loosely affiliated group of supposed terrorists overseas. But of course, in the United States intelligence apparatus, there's all these links with them together. Of course, there's some ties to the Taliban. They're this imminent threat that we must neutralize. But this current phase just goes to show you that any and all reasoning for U.S. involvement in Afghanistan is completely amorphous and ill-defined. Invoking terms like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, what have you, were just ciphers so that the U.S. could expand its imperial hegemony. As an Afghanistan veteran, I'm not surprised in the slightest, because when I was over there, there was no real rhyme or reason to what we're doing. There isn't really one now. And in all of this, the Afghan people themselves don't get a vote. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the only tangible thing that the United States government could do that would benefit the Afghan people is just to leave Afghanistan, full stop and without question.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's quite ironic, you know, that the Trump administration is saying for the first time that they'll openly talk with the Taliban. Of course, these negotiations have already been going on behind the scenes between the U.S.-backed Afghan government and the Taliban.
Of course,
throughout this time, though, that the Taliban, knowing that the U.S.-backed Afghan government, the Afghan government isn't really a thing. It's like, it's just totally fake, unsupported by the people. You know, it's a U.S. It's just a vassal of the U.S. occupation. And so the Taliban has always insisted, there's no, how can we have a negotiation with the Afghan government? The Afghan government is not real. It's totally fake. We want to talk directly to the U.S. if we're going to talk about any kind of power sharing or peace deal. And the U.S. under Bush and Obama always refused to do that, because of course it would look so bad and send such a terrible message to soldiers who were being asked to risk life and limb to fight the Taliban, to then see their commanders, talking with the Taliban in meetings. Of course, that's not an unusual thing. The Taliban leaders were invited to the White House for a barbecue back under Ronald Reagan. You know, they were a friend and backed by the United States up until, the U.S. wanted to build an oil pipeline through Afghanistan and the Taliban didn't approve it. Then all of a sudden, they became this terrible, evil enemy. But, you know, one of the things I found ironic about this story is that if you remember under Obama, when Obama negotiated the release of Bo Bergdahl, who was infantryman in Afghanistan, who was kept as a POW and tortured for so many years by the Taliban. Part of his torture is that he was just kept in the dark for, months and months on end, to where he couldn't, you can't see anything. So he began to forget what he looked like and couldn't even confirm that he existed or was a person. And so just imagine going through that kind of psychological torture. And then to be finally released. And when he was released, it was to the complete attack from the right wing.
Every single conservative in this country, every single chicken hawk, collectively filled their diapers. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. Just the virulent hate that bubbled up, because this guy who had been in a living hell for years was freed by negotiating for supposed Taliban leaders that themselves had been tortured. And again, it was just, for me, I mean, when that occurred, I was in the midst of my time at West Point. It was just so illustrative of how all of this support the troops nonsense is just complete insanity and only used in the justification of perpetual violence and U.S. imperialism.
Oh, it was unbelievable. And they were saying that Bo Bergdahl should be hanged and Obama should be impeached. And the reason for all of that was because it allowed the release of four supposed Taliban leaders who had never stepped foot on a battlefield, never fought in a battle with U.S. soldiers. But because it was so unacceptable to release leaders in the Taliban that you should kill this American soldier who was tortured and impeach the president. Well, what now? I mean, all those right wingers, are they now all of a sudden okay with the Taliban and want to, sit down and have lunch with them and talk about the future of Afghanistan? I mean, it's such a complete contradiction, but it really, that it ties in an important way, because Bo Bergdahl's story You know, the reason that he became a POW, you know, he wasn't a desert. He wasn't going to try to live in Afghanistan. You know, he wasn't, you know, trying to run away and escape to another country. In his own words, Bo Bergdahl, the reason that he left that base is because he was experiencing what everyone in Afghanistan was experiencing at that time. They were just left out in the middle of nowhere to just be a magnet for bullets and mortars for absolutely no reason, run by a completely incompetent leadership from their company level, all the way through the chain of command. And he thought that if he walked off the base and walked something like 15 miles to the next US base, it would trigger a huge investigation, that it would get the attention of high-ranking generals, because his whole intention of doing that was to expose the insane nature of the Afghanistan war and to try to stop the senselessness. But it wanted to bring me back to this experience that he was having, where so much of the Afghanistan war was the U.S., you know, generals love their maps and they love to show that they're in control of so much on maps. So the commanders of Afghanistan really wanted these maps showing American forces controlling all these parts of the country, right? I mean, a lot of these outposts where American forces were, it's like you could not go 50 meters outside the wire before immediately getting attacked. Some places you couldn't even lift your head above the wall without getting shot at. I mean, the U.S. wasn't in control of anything in these areas. They were just like hiding in a bubble where they would just be getting assaulted by like 500 Taliban fighters and just survive long enough for air support to get there 2 hours later and blow everyone up with A-10s. I mean, a really insane period of the war. I don't know if you experienced any of that, Spencer, but it just like the entire, you know, overreach, you know, so much of the death that happened there was just from people being left out in the middle of nowhere, just so some general can boast of where their soldiers are on the map, not caring at all about what happened to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main takeaway from the Bo Bergdahl situation is that the main reason why particularly the brass were extremely upset by all this is not because what Bo Bergdahl did was in any sense a threat to, you know, the mission in Afghanistan. It was because, and Bo Bergdahl is a complicated figure like we all are, and it's very tragic what he had to go through. But if you take time to listen to him, the reason why, you know, commanders went haywire over Bergdahl is because it was a soldier taking action, maybe and not the best possible way, but he did what he thought he could in his particular circumstances to find a way to voice his discontent with what he had witnessed. And, you know, I don't think anyone who claims to have a conscience, you know, especially if you've been in situations such as those in Afghanistan, I mean, to actually take the measures to do what he did, I think you at least have to read his perspective on the matter, and it'll offer you some insight into just this collective delusion that is this endless war in Afghanistan. And speaking of which, Mike, if you wouldn't mind, we had talked about this before the show, but there was a staff sergeant, Matthew Sitton, who had penned a letter regarding his time in Afghanistan.
Right. You know, this is someone else. You know, Bo Bergdahl wasn't alone in realizing that there is this kind of something wasn't right with their mission and their, you know, strategic objective in Afghanistan, whether or not he was, you know, coming to the same political consciousness that we did. Anyone on the ground would know that it was just completely stupid and unnecessary death and destruction. And there's someone named Staff Sergeant Matthew Sitton. This is in 2012. And he wrote a letter to his congressman because he was in a similar position of Bo Bergdahl. He decided not to walk off base and go AWOL to try to trigger some kind of investigation. But instead, he tried to write a letter to his elected official to try to ask for help. And I want to read what he wrote. He says, "Sir, I'm currently deployed in support of Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan. I'm writing to you because I'm concerned for the safety of my soldiers. This is my third combat tour in Afghanistan, so I have seen the transition in rules of engagement and overall tactics in the past 6 years. I'm only writing this email because I feel myself and my soldiers are being put in unnecessary positions where harm and danger are imminent. There is no end state or purpose for the patrols given to us from our higher chain of command, only that we will be out for a certain time standard. As a brigade, we are averaging at minimum an amputee a day from our soldiers because we are walking around aimlessly through grape rows and compounds that are littered with explosives. I just want to return my guys home to their families healthy. I apologize for taking your time like this, sir, and I do appreciate what you do for us. Shortly after writing this email to his congressman, he was killed on one of these patrols that was taking an amputee a day from his unit. He left behind a wife, and he had a firstborn baby child that he never got to see and will never know him. And so this was a different approach. I mean, he felt that it was even apologetic in the email. I'm sorry to take up your time, Mr. Congressman, but a soldier a day is getting his leg blown off. And there's absolutely no reason for what we're doing.
Well, and this was a guy who still believed in this senseless mission, too. Like he embraced the whole army idea, and yet it still chewed him up and just completely spit him out and left behind a broken family. That's what he got for embracing the army full-heartedly.
Absolutely, what a great reward for doing the honorable thing, or what they would say is the honorable thing. I mean, and that connects back down to this main story of the U.S. in talks with the Taliban now, is that at that era of the war in 2012, I mean, this is after the big troop surge by Obama, you know, and this is where, you know, this has since been reined back, but at that time it was just soldiers out everywhere and every valley and every mountaintop that they could be on. All of this under the auspice of defeating the Taliban. I mean, places like Korangal Valley, where, you know, soldiers were told this is the most important valley in the entire war, and we have to go through the worst stuff possible just so we can control this valley because it's so important. Then after like 150 soldiers die there in a matter of years, they just say, oh, well, never mind, we're just gonna leave. So where Staff Sergeant Matthew Sitton was patrolling, being told that we have to go on these foot patrols every day where someone every day is gonna get their leg or their genitals blown off. We have to do it because it's so important. And then they just leave immediately afterwards. I mean, this is literally what led to the rebellion in the Vietnam War, is it wasn't expressly political for so many at first. It was just the absurdity of officers saying, we got to take this hilltop because this is the most important hilltop in the war. And then, you know, 20 soldiers die trying to take this hilltop. And then the next day, they leave the hilltop, and then the people they're fighting go back and take it again. And then they're told to take it again. And just the complete ridiculousness. I mean, anyone can see that. So the politicians and generals knew the entire time, and in fact admitted behind closed doors, that the war was a lost cause with no hope of achieving their military objectives, and that a military retreat was inevitable, like the one that we're seeing today, and talks with the Taliban were inevitable, like we're seeing today. Why wouldn't they just withdraw U.S. soldiers immediately, which the majority of people in the United States in Afghanistan support? No, they favored the same thing they did in Vietnam when they knew that they were going to be defeated there, was what I like to call a slow motion retreat, to hide the reality that they lost the war and to protect the face of the American empire. And so all of the troop surge, the continuing occupation of Afghanistan, all of that was just so the military commanders and politicians often didn't have to take responsibility for a lost war on their watch. It was never about defeating the Taliban. They knew, I mean, they've known from the beginning, as much as they've been telling us, we have to drive the Taliban from power. These politicians and Obama and Bush and all the generals, they knew that that was never actually going to happen. That's just what they were telling us, to get us to go over and over again, put our limbs and lives on the line, do terrible things to people who don't deserve it. I mean, it's just a complete betrayal.
Yeah, and speaking of complete betrayals, I suppose that's a great way for us to segue into another breaking story with regards to the military and how immigrants who expressly joined for citizenship have been slowly but surely being discharged, immigrant recruits. It was reported on July 6th that the U.S. Army has been abruptly discharging immigrant recruits and reservists who enlisted through a program that promised them a path to citizenship. And again, all of this imperialist violence we talk about, this senseless destruction, it's been going on from Bush to Obama and now to Trump. But this era, you know, after Trump's elect, does mark a certain period of time. And I think it does signify that the contradictions have heightened, because you're now starting to witness the population being primed for the exclusion of other people based on qualities of either race or skin color or what have you, in order to support an eventual larger effort of ethnic cleansing. And the history of different fascist regimes that have arisen in the past, this is an absolute red flag that we are entering a period of time where this type of behavior, this type of policy is being normalized, so that when the more pronounced forms of this start to come up, it'll already be ingrained in the public consciousness and seen as something that's completely normal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's nothing but racism that's behind this. I mean, if anyone thinks that there's, like, you know, any other reason why all of a sudden the U.S. Army is just discharging people that they recruited saying, please join the army because we're going to give you citizenship. I mean, it's because, you know, the government is run now by arch racists. I mean, you have people like Stephen Miller in the Trump administration, you know, who's just some punk 30-year-old dude, like pampered kid from Santa Monica, lived on a nice house on the beach his whole life. Is just like a straight up neo-Nazi dude, like seriously, like sporting Nazi medals type neo-Nazi dude.
And he gets off on the suffering of others.
Absolutely. And now he's making all these decisions that are affecting the lives of, you know, immigrants, people in the military, and stuff like that. And so, you know, it's, you know, Trump campaigned on this make the military great again garbage. And this was a reaction to like a shift under Obama, right? You know, that Obama started downsizing the number of regular army troops, you know, after this huge buildup under Bush, and then put a more focus on drones and special operations and things like that. And in fact, you know, it screwed over a lot of soldiers who all of a sudden started getting kicked out on these bad paper discharges. Trump comes in and he's like, you know what? He's like, I know the military is being downsized and we're going to make the military great again and stop that, you know, that lame liberal Obama policy of making the military smaller. So he is campaigning on the whole idea of increasing the number of soldiers and increasing the force of the military. And so to say that and to be doing that, you know, they just increased the military budget by like $50 billion. That increase alone is larger than the entire military budget of Russia, you know, which is pretty wild. But to be doing that and then simultaneously discharging numbers of veterans simply because they're immigrants, I mean, there's no reason other than racism that they're doing that.
Right. And it shows you how it's a structural feature, not only in American society at large, but especially in the United States military. Now, I myself, particularly in basic training and in some of my other military, I did encounter a variety of people with different backgrounds, creeds, what have you. But if I'm not mistaken, Mike, you actually have a couple of real-life examples and people you knew who were immigrants joining for this citizenship policy and program that the military offered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to go back in history a little bit to find out where this came from. I mean, this was a Bush-era policy that said, you know, you didn't even have to live in the United States. I mean, I served with someone who is from Ghana, had never been to the United States. Like, army recruiters went to Ghana to recruit people in Ghana and said, join the army, we'll give you citizenship. So his first trip to the United States was when he came and went to basic training. But the reason that this policy was enacted is because when the Iraq war started going badly, you know, when it was just all of a sudden, you know, hundreds of U.S. soldiers were being killed and maimed, and it was obvious that there is absolutely no way to defeat the Iraqi resistance, and the politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, refused to just end the war and leave, but just kept sending more and more people to die, people just stopped joining the army. Recruitment numbers were at record lows. That's why they had to implement stop loss, where all these soldiers who joined and thought they signed a 2-year contract or a 4-year contract, all of a sudden they got stuck in for 8 years and went to Iraq like 5 different times for like, that's when they increased the deployment length. Some people did like over 20-month deployments. People like in the National Guard, people that were never supposed to leave the borders of the United States were deployed. People like, I remember the Honor Guard got deployed to Iraq. I mean, people that were just drill and ceremony experts. I mean, this is because nobody was joining and they're out of people and they needed to just keep sending people to this meat grinder. So one of the things they did at this time, in addition to stop lashing people and deploying the National Guard, which was unheard of, was they came up with this policy of trying to recruit immigrants to join for citizenship. And one of the, I mean, it was just really repulsive the way they did. They had this whole campaign called Yo Soy El Army, where they decked out these Humvees, good like with God. Spinner rims on it. And they'd pull up. I mean, I remember, you know, in Florida, they'd pull up to the high school with like some spinner rims, Hummer, bumping reggaeton music. And they would just be looking for people that were, you know, people who needed citizenship and say, well, join the army, do this 2 years, you know, and then you get your citizenship. I mean, I had a friend when I was in the NCO Academy who was undocumented. He joined for citizenship. And like the army wouldn't even recognize that he was married because he was undocumented. He was like living in the barracks with his wife. It was really insane. But then one of the crazy things is then all these people joined for citizenship, get out. And then many of them, even after going to Iraq and Afghanistan, didn't get the citizenship after getting honorably discharged. And in fact, some have even been deported after going in for citizenship, honorably discharged, serve in Iraq, and then get out. And they get deported back to Mexico and Central America. It's insane.
Yeah. No. And again, and many of these people who joined with the chance of receiving U.S. citizenship now go back to countries that have been torn to shreds because of either direct U.S. imperialism or encroachment or U.S. influence on other players or actors in the region that have just ripped their home countries to shred because of the U.S.'s number one motivation of profit. So with that in mind, though, again, we cannot emphasize enough that if you're in right now and you're witnessing this, if you're friends with, you know, these immigrant recruits or perhaps you might have just become acquaintances with them, if there's anything that is, you know, a glaring indication that the military structurally does not care about you as a human, that you are merely an expendable part, just a cog in the imperialist machine, this is it. Because people who come from all across the globe to join this imperialist army are being kicked out with an uncharacterized discharge most of the time, yep. I might add. This is all the more reason to resist and start taking a stand and show your solidarity with the truly oppressed peoples of the world. If you want to fight for freedom, liberation, democracy, if you want those words to not just be adjectives, but actual tangible actions, then this is the first step towards resisting, opposing this priming of a population for ethnic cleansing on a large scale.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's hard to think now how this will be looked at in the mirror of history. But, you know, if anyone who resists in the military now because of these policies, I mean, it may seem difficult now, but you will be absolved by history. You will be vindicated by history because this era is going to be looked at as a just an increasingly fascistic, arch-racist era. And it's and you can't just say, I mean, if you're in the military now and you're thinking, well, I hate the Trump administration, because, you know, I would say the majority of people think Trump is an idiot and doesn't want him being their commander-in-chief. You can't just point the finger at the Trump administration. Well, the Trump administration's racist and all these people are racist and ICE and Border Patrol are having a field day with it. The army is doing this. It's not Trump that's doing this. The U.S. Army is following these orders to kick people out for no people that they entice into the military and promise things, and is just kicking them out because they are people of color. It's the army doing that. It's the army that is supporting the mission of going to the border and having young men and women in the National Guard who come from poor communities, who come from oppressed and immigrant communities, sending them to go catch and deport and separate these families that are being arrested at the border, to arrest children at the border and put them in jails. It's the army that's doing this. You can't absolve the army leadership or the army as an institution. They are very much a part of it. And so you're a part of it too, if you're in the military. And you know, Spencer, it kind of evokes one of the big crises in the Vietnam War, right? Is that, you know, so much of the resistance in Vietnam within the military and resistance to the draft was African-American soldiers and draftees who said, why would I go fight in some other country, in life in some other country, when in my own country, there's extreme racism and state repression against us for no reason except the color of our skin?
Absolutely. Muhammad Ali famously stated that when he refused to go fight in the Vietnam War. An act of individual resistance that laid a foundation for future acts of rebellion such as those exhibited by Colin Kaepernick today.
Absolutely. And, you know, Muhammad Ali, his statement when he refused to fight in Vietnam, resonates today with what's going on with the state of immigrants in the United States in the military. He said, "Why should they ask me to put on a uniform and go tens of thousands of miles from home and drop bombs and bullets on brown people in Vietnam while so-called Negro people in Louisville are treated like dogs and denied simple human rights? No, I'm not going 10,000 miles from home to help murder and burn another poor nation simply to continue the domination of white slave masters of the darker people the world over. This is the day when such evils must come to an end." And I mean, I think that that is especially true today, not just for immigrant soldiers and families of immigrants, but if you're someone, like you said, who cares about humanity and human rights and equality, you can't support what the military is doing right now. Yeah, and I think in that vein of the heroic resistance during the Vietnam War, of which Muhammad Ali was a part of, but of course, not the only one, it brings us to our segment on radical military history.
Radical.
Today, your soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardmen are better educated than before, are better informed, and understand what the war is all about.
Spencer, what do you got for us?
History is the fruit of power. So says historian Michel Rolf Trouillot in his seminal text, Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History. Now, Trouillot, in his book, takes a few historical examples, among them, most importantly, the Haitian Revolution of 1791, to talk about how the Western canon and historical narrative suppresses or kind of ignores historical moments in the pursuit of a larger meta-narrative of society. And so with that in mind, those words will kind of be our guiding light for this recurring segment. Well, we'll examine moments in military history where people or are sometimes individuals participated in actions that resulted in, you know, implications and second and third order, effects for social movements that either ended a war or affected it in such a way that a revolution was born out of a tragedy. And so for our opening segment, I thought it would be fitting if we would invoke the individual act of resistance. And this happened early, before Winter Soldier, before the large mass movements, an isolated protest. But in this isolated protest, historical significance. In June of 1965, Captain Richard Steinke, a West Point graduate in Vietnam, refused to board an aircraft taking him to a remote Vietnamese village. He said, "The Vietnamese war is not worth a single American life." Now, of course, Captain Steinke's formulation of his opposition to the war may be a bit limited and narrow, but the first steps towards a larger consciousness and recognizing, you know, his solidarity with the Vietnamese people and anti-war activists and war resistors the world over. He, after refusing his orders to deploy, was court-martialed and dismissed from the service. He himself received a less than honorable discharge. The following year, in February of 1966, a decorated Special Forces Master Sergeant Donald Duncan, he returned from his time overseas, and he published a powerful indictment of the war, and it was titled "The Whole Thing Was a Lie." Now, at the time, there was a number of different left-wing magazines in circulation, and this was in the magazine Ramparts. Master Sergeant Duncan's statements were particularly shocking because here you have a guy who had done it all in the military. He was at the pinnacle of what would be considered a soldier who had arrived, and he himself took the necessary steps to tank his career and have solidarity with the Vietnamese people. But again, it's like one event led to another, because not too long after that, then later that year, the incident of the Fort Hood 3 occurred. Now, this is particularly inspiring because this was three privates. And now you'll see these three privates. One of them was black, and that was James Johnson. There was David Samas, who was a Lithuanian-Italian-American, and Dennis Mora, who was Puerto Rican. So three Army privates of varying backgrounds stood together, all of them from poor communities, and they refused to deploy to Vietnam, and they denounced the war as immoral, illegal, and unjust. And I want to mention a couple more. Now, this one, Captain Howard Levy, this is one of the more well-known incidents, but in early 1967, Captain Levy was an Army doctor at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and he himself refused to teach Green Berets, which, of course, you know, one of the most elite units in the military. He referred to them as murderers of women and children and killers of peasants. He was court-martialed because, according to the Army, he was trying to promote disaffection among enlisted men by his statements. And the colonel at his trial, again, and one of the most obvious hand tips of, you know, historical memory, said that the truth of the statements is not an issue in this case. And so I think that, much like we talked about Trujillo's earlier statements and history being the fruit of power, in many ways the truth doesn't matter when it comes to those in power and how they use history to their advantage and how they try to promote a particular narrative. And since we're discussing Vietnam, it would be imperative of me to also inform you, if you're not aware, that this idea that soldiers were spat upon is a complete mythology propped up by Hollywood. And all it does is serve the interests of the endless war we have today. It is a very recent mythology, probably 20, 30 years old tops, and it completely contradicts the actual history, which is active duty personnel leading the way in terms of the anti-war movement of its time. I'll leave you with one more figure, and this is a Navy nurse, Lieutenant Susan Schnall, who was court-martialed for marching in a peace demonstration, as well as dropping anti-war leaflets from a plane on Navy installations. So you see the extent that military personnel were willing to go during this era. And in many ways, these figures, I bring them up because right now, I think we kind of occupy a similar historical moment. We are in retreat in terms of the anti-war movement, but much like I took a stand, you are just as capable. I'm not special. I'm just one guy who happened to do it. Mike happened to do it, and all of these people decided that enough is enough. And you too can make history and align yourself with a radical tradition of people who have resisted empire and chosen humanity over an obsequious deference to the empire. So again, there's more to unpack with these figures. If you want some sources, I am following the great Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, his chapter on Vietnam. But if you want to read any deeper on these, I mean, anywhere, Counterpunch, there's a number of different pieces of literature out there for you to understand the initial phases of the anti-war movement. Now, of course, as the series progresses, as our podcast, you know, as we gain some traction, we'll go into the, you know, the Winter Soldier investigations. We'll go into the larger anti-war movement. But today, since we're in our early stages, I want you to know that if you're considering speaking out, if you're considering, you know, leaving the military on whatever terms works for you, that individual acts of resistance are historically important and meaningful, and they can lay the foundation for a larger anti-war movement and social movement that changes society for the better. You've been listening to Eyes Left with Spencer Rapone
and Mike Preisner. All of our content is free for everyone, but we can't do it without your help. So if you support this project, go to patreon.com/eyesleft to make it possible to continue. Be sure to follow us on social media at Eyes Left Pod.
And if you're in the military, a military family member, or a veteran and want to share your story, report problems and mismanagement, or need advice or assistance knowing your rights, including your right to get the hell out or refuse deployment, please write us at eyesleftpod@gmail.com.
Eyes Left.